Good morning.
House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Thank you, colleagues, for being here bright and early this morning. I want to spend just a minute to talk about the agenda, and then we'll go to adoption of committee rules. For those here who are here on bills, I want to let you know that my current plan is to start with the last bill on the agenda, proceed to the one above it, go to the first bill on the agenda as the third item, and then at 9 o'clock deal with the two bills that have to do with the 911 issue at 9 o'clock. So with that, we will open an organizational meeting for the adoption of committee rules. Paul, would you tell us about that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have your committee rules under meeting materials. Is the standard rules that you're familiar with. The only difference that I would point out is on near the bottom of the second page, number 15, you have a little bit shorter time element for a minority report. Filing a minority report has to be filed 5 o'clock of the day in which notice is given rather than waiting till the next day for the deadline. So that, of course, is to accommodate the shorter session. So that's the only change in your rules from what you had during the last session.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the rules as presented.
Representative Berger moves the adoption of the rules as printed. Discussion? Any objection to the rules as printed? Seeing no objection, the rules are adopted. Let's open close the organizational meeting, open a public hearing on House Bill 4148. Have I got the numbers wrong?
I must be on the wrong.
Good morning.
Good morning. Oh, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Do we have signups? Paul's bringing up.
House Bill 4148 is a measure that would change the interest calculation for senior deferral participants beginning in property tax year 2014-15. It would change it from a 6% compounded annually to a 6% simple interest calculation. And I have, you'll see in your meeting materials, sort of an outline of what the account balances are expected to be both with this policy and without this policy. This incorporates the changes that were made in House Bill 2510, as well as the additional lost repayments that would come from shifting this 6% simple to 6% compound. And so the balance in 2014 is expected to be $8 million after that. And then 2015, it would begin to see the impact from the shift and be $8.4 million instead of $8.5. The annual impact from that change would ramp up to approximately $1 million a year into the future. But this does incorporate the 2013 actuals as well as the changes that have been made in House Bill 2510 to add those people back to the program.
Very good. Representative Gomberg and Representative Nathanson. There they are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. Representative Gomberg will also be providing information for you in a moment. I'm here with one objective, which is to help low and moderate income homeowners by reducing the interest rate we charge them. This is a bill that is targeted very narrowly. It affects one program only, the Homestead Property Tax Deferral Program. That program has a provision allowing interest to be charged on money owed to the state. The interest on that money, according to every other program we know about in the state, used to be calculated as a simple interest. It was changed in 2011, It was changed to help bring in more revenue to help keep the program solvent. The program is on sound footing again. We believe it is not essential for the program to keep this compound interest rate, which is apparently the only example of any state program that we know of which does this, charges compound interest rate. It appears that the projected additional revenue for the next year is $89,000. So it would not substantively impact the program that year. It appears to be a small change for a program that the program can handle the difference, but a big change for people who need it. This would primarily, for example, be beneficial for seniors on a fixed income and people who manage a very tight household budget. Every dollar counts, and every couple of $100 to a household on a fixed income counts a lot, and we believe that this program is on sound footing enough that it can handle the change. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. David Gomberg from House District 10. This issue was first brought to my attention by a constituent who is involved in the program and was concerned that the value of her home was being eroded by the collection by the state of compound interest. And she pointed out to me that this was the only program in the state that, in fact, collects compound interest. I'm going to share with you, for the record, some of the testimony I presented to you previously so that we've got a complete record. The property tax deferral program for disabled and senior citizens was established nearly 30 years ago to provide assistance to low and moderate income homeowners. Until 2011, eligibility for the program was primarily based on age, that is 62, and household income, which is currently $42,000. The program is intended to be self-sustaining and at its peak had over 11,000 qualified participants. Now, in the fall of 2010, the Department of Revenue, who administers the program, notified the legislature that the program's reserves were depleted and it would not be able to make full payment on property taxes due to local governments. And because of that situation, they made a number of changes in the program. We're here today to talk about one of those changes. The program had utilized simple interest rate of 6% up until that 2011 date, and then the rate on the accrued deferral tax balance was changed to 6% compounded annually. The intent of the compounded interest rate was to generate funds in excess of administrative costs and help replenish the program's reserves. Well, the reserves of the property tax deferral program are growing and positive and have positive projections for the future. So we are proposing that the interest rate on the deferred balances revert back to the simple rate of 6%. The program was never intended to be a revenue producer for the state. Further, Representative Nathanson indicated, all of our research indicates this is the only program in the state that collects compound interest on any monies owed to the state. Since the program's participation numbers are stable and the reserve funds are replenished, it's only fair to reduce the interest charged on the deferred balances and return to the previous simple interest rate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions for the representatives? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony very much, and hopefully we've done it quickly enough to get you onto your own committee. John Mullen, Jody Weiser, Rick Bennett, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon.
Just one moment. Let me interrupt.
Sure.
Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this bill today? We will be asking the department to answer some questions. Other than that, all right, please go ahead. And I'm sorry, I stepped on your name, so
no,
you can
no
do
problem.
That again.
For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'm here today in support of House Bill 4148. But I want to begin by talking about the action that this committee took back in 2011, because there's no doubt about the fact that this committee had an urgent issue and basically saved the program. The actions that the committee took after that in 2012-2013 were able to make changes to modify the program to bring additional people back into the program, the reverse mortgage issue that was dealt with in the 2012 session. Those people who did not get back into the program but were otherwise eligible, the changes that were made in the 2013 session, House Bill 2510, these were important changes that affected large numbers of people, and those of us who have worked with the committee really appreciate the fact that not only did this committee take those issues on, but if I remember correctly, everywhere along the line, every step along the line with the changes that happened, passed unanimously in committee, in the House floor, in the Senate committee, and the Senate floor. And so this is something that we have all done together, working in a bipartisan manner. And so when it comes to this issue, while it's not a huge issue the dollar-wise, to a number of us, it seems it's a simple matter of fairness, and it's something that's within the grasp of the legislature to do. I don't want to repeat the comments that Representative Nathanson and Representative Gomberg made, but the purpose of the program is to provide this kind of relief for people and not really to grow the program beyond the revenue that's needed to sustain it. So we believe that this is a reasonable ask this session, a simple, uncomplicated bill before you about making an improvement to the program that we think is reasonable. Thank you very much.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. I think this change makes really good sense, but there's one other change I think should be made, and I would caution your interest in it. Right, I just got a mortgage last year on my home, and my interest rate is about 1.5% below this, and it is compound. I mean, considering the compound, right? And that seems fair because the state's carrying a lot more risk than is being carried by the bank on my home. But right now, a 6% rate makes sense. We all know, some of us in this room remember when home mortgage interest rates were 14%. And it would make sense for, instead of having a set 6% simple interest, we had a law that said the interest rate for new applicants to the program floats so much above the current typical mortgage rate, because we could otherwise put ourselves back into the same problem we went through, so, you know, the massive mess we faced a few years ago. It may not be something we want to do this session, but I think it's something that we should pay attention to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon, speaking in support of House Bill 4148. I've got one comment related to the current bill as introduced, and then I have a couple of comments related to concerns that have been voiced as we've talked to various people about this bill. First of all, as you know, at various times I've talked about AARP's principles related to taxation. One of those principles has to do with ease of administration, and that is an issue that came up a number of times in 2011 when we were talking about various changes that might be considered and implemented as far as our efforts to save this program and ensure its solvency into the future. Because of that, I would also the question for me, as far as the bill is introduced, is how this simple rate of interest would be applied. I believe related to ease of administration and so forth, I would suggest that it would really apply to any lien, whatever the term of art is, as far as when a lien comes due and you and the state collects that balance due and so forth, that any lien that came due after the effective date of this bill, the entire balance of the deferred taxes would be covered by the simple rate. I'm not sure if that is how the bill is currently written. Frankly, the art of bill drafting is a mystery to me. So I'm just suggesting that you look at that. And I think I've talked to a few people about this, including the department, and my sense is that this would be perhaps the preferred way to do it, rather than having a simple rate charge on the balance through mid-2011, then a period of time where the compound rate is charged, and then another period of time where perhaps a simple rate would be charged again and so forth. So I just ask you to take a look at that particular aspect of the bill. Related to issues that have come up as we've discussed this bill beforehand, certainly a number of people have voiced the need for caution as we make any changes in this program and the impact it might have on the reserves of the program. And and I would say John and I and others share that concern and want to also be very cautious as far as how we move forward. I received calls from our members and so forth, as you received calls from constituents after the 2011 session and the impact that some of the changes that were made in the program had on individuals and so forth. Some of those conversations were heartbreaking, and I know that you experienced similar conversations as well and so forth. We certainly don't want to find ourselves in a position like that again. On the other hand, the reserves of the program continue to grow. I would suggest that I think we're on the right track on that. I don't want to seem like the state economist in talking about probability and risk and so forth for the future, but I would suggest to you that both because of the continuing improvement of the economy and the housing market, that improvement is slow and gradual, but it continues to be moving in the right direction. And I would suggest also because of the changes, some of the changes you made in this program in 2011, including capping the number of new participants in any that might be considered in any one year and so forth, that the program is in fact stable. As I said, the reserves continue to grow, and I think the projections that staff has done would indicate that the change from a compound rate to a simple rate, the impact on the program, while any impact is of importance and so forth, would still be relatively small. And so, in that regard, we would. Like, as I said, we share your concern for the reserves and so forth, but we believe that the increase or impact on the program related to this particular bill would be something that we could do without seriously negatively impacting the reserves of the program. The other issue that's come up is the cost associated for the Department of Revenue in making IT changes and so forth. As you know, and you've had reports, I think, last month on the ongoing progress of the core IT project for the Department of Revenue. That's been going on for some time. I understand, based on their report last month, that they anticipate the initial work to be completed sometime this fall. However, at this point, based on conversations that I had with the department last fall, as well as last week, it's my understanding that the IT changes related to this program, and particularly the compound interest rate, are not in place. And in fact, any liens that come due at this point, the simple rate of interest is can be computed based until mid-2011, and then from that point to the present, the compound rate basically has to be figured out by hand, and then those two amounts added together to determine the total amount of interest due on the deferred tax balance. So, I'm not quite sure what the current estimates of cost are as far as this bill and the change we're suggesting and so forth. I would like to be certain that, in fact, any cost associated with changing to a simple rate are related only to that change and not necessarily related to changes related to the compound interest rate and legislation in 2011. So I would also ask you just to look very carefully at any estimates related to the cost associated with this bill. And with that, again, I would close as John has, and just, again, thank you for your work over the last several years related to this program. I've had numerous conversations with you privately and in front of you as a committee and so forth. I really appreciate your interest in ensuring that this program continues to exist and be on firm financial grounds and so forth. Clearly, the intent, I believe, based on the conversations I've had with you, was to ensure that older homeowners, if needed, had some assistance to, if at all possible, make sure that they can continue to live in their home, live in their communities, and not be faced with the possibility of losing their home because they couldn't pay their property taxes and so forth. It's not about, it has never been, as far as I know, about trying to preserve an asset for heirs or whatever. It's just about trying to ensure that people who want to live and age in place can do so. And again, I thank you very much for your interest and your work on this program. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Phillips?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
While he's coming up, I would appreciate it if our staff would look into the question that was raised about your projections, whether they are based on going back all the way on compounding or current law and then compounding.
Mr. Sheriff, Senator Berger, the the projections are of House Bill 4148 as written, which is that the shift happens from compound interest to simple interest for 2014 onward, and so that remains compound interest in that time window.
Thank you.
Representative Berger, did you have some questions?
Yes, my concern with this bill, Mr. Chair, as you well know, you and I have spent an awful lot of effort on this issue and want this program to continue successfully. I also, quite frankly, having been here when this fund was too rich and the legislature tended to grab it for other purposes, which is a tendency when funds get too rich, and that was proved to be a problem. This is not a reserve fund for the legislature. We want to keep this fund well supported so that we don't have to jeopardize the program. But on the other hand, I'm persuaded that we really don't want to make money off this program. We want to keep people in their homes. But I have another concern, and that's enormous, and that is the core system replacement project of the Department of Revenue, which I have invested a lot of time in, and which is at that golden moment where we have to implement, and, you know, sometimes IT projects don't work out real well. Maybe you've noticed. And this is one that I really want to work out very well. So I've asked that Mr. Phillips come forward and talk about what this means for the core system replacement project and whether this can be fit into a reasonable workload issue at this time. Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. Representative Berger, thank you for the question. My name is John Phillips, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'd be happy to answer that because that is the first thing that came to our minds when we read the bill. A very simple change to the law, one word, but a significant change for our staff. We had the same concern back in 2011 when the law was changed to compute compound. And at that time, I told you that we had a 30-year-old legacy system, that we would have to have people found that could understand that language and work to change that language. The whole foundation of the tax calculation and interest calculation is something that we would never do today. So we estimated, I think at that time, maybe in the fiscal was like $100,000 to make the change. I think we're just over $60,000 into it. And where we are, and I'll nuance Rick Bennett's comments just a little bit to say that we have made programming changes. We have run examples. Many of the test examples come out accurate. A lot don't. So when we calculate payoffs, we do double check with by hand. So we're still doing that, unfortunately, but that's what we've got to work with. What you would do if you pass this bill as it is you would, of course, set up at least about 6,000 people who would have simple interest up to 2011, compound interest to this year, and then simple interest into the future. We would then have to proceed to go in and modify our legacy system, and we also would then be planning to change the new core systems replacement system so that when it comes up in 16, it will do whatever the law says at that time. So we would be basically running two programming sets at the same time. Our suggestion, and I totally agree with everything that was said by the representatives about the interest rate and the importance of the policy. Our suggestion would be to pursue the policy and administrative ease by, if you're going to pass this legislation, make it so that it's not effective until 2016, so that we can make one change to one system, and then if you want, you could make that retroactive. We could program that, and we could plan for that. And that way, you would have everybody as of the effective date of the bill be on a simple interest, and all the compound discussion would go away. Now, the only thing you'd have is that between now and then, whatever payoffs there were would be calculated on compound. So that is our target for implementation of the senior deferral, which is one of the first programs to be, not the first, but one of the first programs to be changed into the new system, and that would be the fall of 16. On our list of ease of administration, the very bottom one, the most difficult, would be to implement a variable rate. So there's this continuum of ease and difficulty, and that's where we're at. So does that answer your question, Representative?
Yes, and it does, and I'm very, you can't do policy from here and solve all problems, but I am appreciative that you've come forward with a solution that would fit within the parameters of what we're trying to do and would help with this core system replacement project, which is so critical to the department and our tax system. So what you're proposing would take an amendment that would simply say that full implementation, and then it would back it up so that anybody up until then, between whatever, we could say going all the way back, they would recalculate by simple interest all the way back. And the only people then who would potentially not get this would be those people who sold their asset during the period when the compound interest was in effect. Is that what you're proposing?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Berger, that's correct. The people that have already paid off for one reason or another, either they've refinanced their home or they've died and transferred the property and paid the compound interest for the couple years that have already elapsed, would be water under the bridge, so to speak. That would be paid and not refunded.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody paying off between now and then, we even thought seriously about, would this affect people's behavior? Would they make decisions based on this? We concluded that it would not be that much difference because often these payoffs occur involuntarily.
Chair. I'm very persuaded that this would be a good proposal, and would like, I know this is scheduled for public hearing, but I would like to have the opportunity for an amendment.
Well, we weren't planning the whole work session on anything today. So,
okay.
So I think there'll be time for drafting of an amendment to make this all work. Other questions for the department? I'm not sure you said this, but are you satisfied, given the numbers that we're getting about the differences between compound and simple interest, that we can maintain the solvency of the fund if we make this change as you were suggesting in terms of the timing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. We, based on the projections that Legislative Revenue Office has made in our research department, we think we are going to be able to make it. We've got some additional people coming into the program, and that's limited. And it would it to the extent that future changes are made that I don't know about, I think we'd be okay.
Well, I think it's fair to say that is that those of us with experience in making sure we didn't close this program are probably more concerned about that issue than anything else.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4148 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4072. Have I got it right?
Affirmative.
Right, great. We'll open that public hearing, and we'll hear from Representative Olson and whoever else he wants to bring up at this moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative from the Albany area. And I just want to thank you very much for this opportunity for me to come and testify before you on behalf of House Bill 4072. This is a simple measure which creates a subtraction from federal...
Representative, I've gotten out of order, and I apologize for that.
BJ, yeah,
I would I'd like to hear from staff, and then we'll take your testimony.
Okay, disregard then.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee.
And why don't you start by introducing yourself again, and then we'll hear what you have to say.
Sure. Vijay Satyal, just started Legs Revenue Office. Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, this bill is House Bill 4072. It basically creates a subtraction from the federal taxable income for up to $500 in cash dividends paid by the employer to the employee for participating in a workplace wellness program. This would be, if the bill is as it is, would be applicable to tax years beginning 2015. And just as of last evening, there was an Amendment 1, which changes the subtraction amount from $500 to, I think, $300.
That's right.
Thank you. Now, Mayor. Representative Olson. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
I appreciate
Chair,
your indulgence.
Members, and just for the benefit for Representative Reed, I meant to actually say 1243, which is disregard previous message. Okay, thank you. Anyways, thanks for this opportunity to come before you today. And immediately to my right is Dr. Larry Mullins. He is the president and CEO of Samaritan Health Services of three counties, Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. And he's going to share a little bit, too, with what they've done. But it's a privilege to have him with me to take a little bit of time. This is a simple measure, and you already know from what Vijay has shared with you that there's a Dash 1 amendments to drop this down to $300 as a cash dividend paid by employer to an employee for participation in a workplace wellness program. The goal of the Oregon Health Benefit Dividend Plan is threefold: to increase access, to increase quality, to reduce costs. Currently, there are a number of organizations that have developed a similar plan that fosters a healthier workplace and provides a reward to employees for making healthy lifestyle choices. The Public Employees Benefit Board, PEB's health engagement model, which is known as HEM, and Samaritan Health Services are both seeing large benefits in keeping people healthy. Participation in the voluntary worksite wellness program is dependent on an initial health assessment. Based upon individual outcome of this assessment, employees participate in one or more of the following: a fitness program, a weight control program, nutritional education program, and a tobacco use cessation or prevention program. The obvious benefits are improved health status of employees, employers' business receiving a healthier workforce, workers' compensation costs decrease, and health claim costs either decrease or do not increase at all. Now, Mr. Chair, I have, I think I have two panels that I would like to have follow here real quick as soon as Dr. Mullins shares, but obviously Dr. Jack Lees, who is the brainchild of this bill and this concept, I was going to share a little bit about what his business down there in Albany does, as well as Nadine Woods, who is one of his employees, as one panel, and Tom Glogau, CPA from the Albany area, will be there as a second panel. And then the third panel will be Jim Asselson from YMCA and also John Powell, which you all know. But I appreciate this opportunity. I in closing from my remarks on this is that there was an assessment, evaluation I think you should have that VJ did for me here yesterday. I appreciate that. I think you should all have that. It's kind of a nutshell version of what 25 to 75% participation rate would be toward this, given a $250 to $500 wellness program. And you can see that at the 25% participation for the first 2 years of 2015 to 17, it was going to be up in the neighborhood of about $20 million for investment from the state of Oregon for this. That's got to be a drop in the bucket if you think about it, compared to what we've just seen happen with Cover Oregon here. And I think our goal really is, as legislators, we have a great opportunity through this to make Oregon healthier. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Larry Mullins. I'm President and Chief Executive Officer of Samaritan Health Services. The paper I'm going to take you through is the one that has the pretty picture of several of our Oregon communities on the front of it, which represent the different communities that we have the privilege of serving. I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 4072, which in essence would create an incentive for wellness both to the employer and to the individual. And I want to start off by thanking Representative Andy Olson and Dr. Jack Lees for their continued efforts in this regard. If you'll turn to the second page on the new vision of health care, I think it's really, really important that you consider this proposition in the context of what we're going through right now with health care reform and a movement towards population health. So literally an investment in this regard could be a savings down
the youngest that had ever been selected for that kind of.
What was that?
That sounds like a hardware glitch. I think we should ignore it. Go ahead.
Okay, keep going. Okay, so the point I was getting to, but I thought that was maybe somebody against healthcare. I wasn't sure. but in any event, I think in today's times with all the reform activities, coordinated care organizations, accountable care, and so forth, this type of a measure can directly have a benefit to the community and a cost savings to the state downstream. The specific program I want to speak to you about is the one that's called SAMFIT and the wellness-related activities of that. And it's more than just a fitness concept or working out at a gym per se. It's a cultural and social change for the individual. If you can turn back to the page that starts at 2012, this is where I've got some information for you that might be of interest, which is a look at our own group of employees. We have about 5,000 employees. About 3,500 of us participated in a pretty definitive study going back a few years ago in terms of our health status. So the pendulum that you see in front of you there, the chart, represents how healthy or how at risk we were. If you look on the left-hand side of the chart, you get to the 8%. Those are people that are probably going to be very, very healthy all their life and won't really have to do much of anything. They got great gene pools or whatever the factors might be, but they're really in great shape. If you look to the far right-hand side of the pendulum there, you'll see where we have people at high risk. In fact, we had a couple of percentages that were what we classified as catastrophic risk. And for not just purposes of the study, but for their own self-benefit, we did initiate some direct interventions with them to see if we could achieve some better health outcomes. The second page, and maybe the one that's more relevant to this bill and its potential impact, is how we moved over the course of a two-year period to a much healthier state. If you look on the left-hand side of the bar, you can see that we almost doubled the healthier population. That was moving some of the people that were healthy to begin with, but got them into an extreme state of health. And we were able to shift to the right-hand side of the bar people to get less at risk as we went forward. Now, most of this was done not through surgical interventions or things of that nature, but through lifestyle changes, through cultural changes, and so forth. So the successes we can point out to you, if you go back to the next page, I think are fairly significant. First, we had a significant amount of engagement from our employees, in part because we did create a $300 incentive for them on an annualized basis as long as they utilized it to engage in healthy activities, which we did require them to quantify. So they couldn't just say we're doing it. They had to validate it and prove they were doing it. We know some of these numbers are kind of staggering, but they're real numbers. 2.2 tons of weight loss over the course of the year from the same population that was studied. Again, this was weight loss that was occurring through activity, not through other interventions. We also saw a significant reduction in medical expense trends, and we could track that because we pay our own health insurance. So we could track the cost as a business to healthcare cost for us as we invested in the improved health status of our employees. Some of the other factors I think you would expect, 8% improvement in total cholesterol, that's just a measurement of the lipids and the state of a person's health status in regards to that. 3% improvement in blood pressure. And I think as far as one very determinative factor here, was we had about 600 employees that we really picked up on unidentified health risk that we, again, got them in for some interventions that helped. The challenges we had, I don't think were any different than society at large. We had 60% of our population that was, by definition, overweight or obese. We had 57% that could not meet a minimum exercise, physical activity requirement. We had just about half that weren't eating, as probably most of us don't eat well on a daily basis. And we even had 5% within the healthcare field using tobacco. So trying to intervene for that and going to smoke-free campuses was a challenge. So is it worth it? Maybe more for this committee's benefit. The last page or two really speaks to that. We had a 5% reduction in worksite injuries. Now, that correlated as a business to about $1 million less cost to us. Now, it's hard to say that we can correlate the physical activity to the workforce reduction activity, but it was the first year that that happened during that period of time. I already mentioned the weight loss overall, which had significant effects on people's lives in a number of different ways. But maybe the one that's of greatest interest would be the medical claims reduction. We saw a significant reduction to the employees that engaged in activity, while we saw an increase in the employees that did not. And the magnitude of that was in excess of $1 million. So, again, if you want to talk economic impact, you want to talk productivity, you want to talk about the value to society, I think you can measure those things pretty quantitatively. Now, what did we get recognized for in that regard? That's the two symbols on the right. We were recognized as the healthiest employer in the state of Oregon by the Portland Business Journal, an honor we weren't expecting, but we gladly accepted. We were competing with some very significant other organizations in that regard. And then we found out, and we weren't even aware we were under consideration for it, we came out with the third healthiest employer in the nation award. So this is very doable. I think it can demonstrate on a fairly limited budgetary basis a great return that can come back. The increased productivity should correlate to increased activity, which should affect tax revenues and other things certainly that you'd have more interest in. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that completes my comments. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Question, Representative Berger, please.
Mr. Mullins, this is a fascinating data that you've done, and you're to be applauded.
Thank you.
Do you have plans to continue the study portion of this on into the future? Because one of the things that I've found is that the weight that I lose is hard to keep off. And without the focus that you as an organization, this is an ongoing concern and not necessarily related to this particular effort, but I think this is a wonderful cohort that shows how focus on wellness can change behavior. And the question is, will you be continuing this so we can see over a greater amount of time if it continues?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman Berger, absolutely. In fact, we're going to expand the scope of the study, and one evidence of that is the band that I'm wearing right now, which is there's a pilot group of us that are being tracked literally on our calorie activity, our activities of engagement on a daily basis, sleep patterns, and other things. So we think it's a real robust area for study that can be of benefit to the community, but you're absolutely right. It's as much as anything a cultural change, and the minor investment comparatively that we would make into that as a society can reap significant benefits downstream. And as I stated early on, especially with the population health mandate that we have and from the state's perspective especially, we need to control health status. If we don't control health status, then all the work, all the effort will be in vain, trust me, as we go forward, and the cost will just multiply and magnify on us. So you're absolutely right. It is something that we should continue to study, and we'll be continuing with this group, by the way, for probably many, many years. Somewhat like previous studies have been done on populations over 10, 20-year periods to really see the long-term benefit. And fortunately, in our community, there's not a lot of out-migration. So when people stay there, I think we're going to have pretty much the same study set. And 3,500 is a significant population to really look at definitively.
Thank you for this.
Thank you.
And you're planning to continue. Oh, excuse me. Representative Conger and then Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a comment and then two questions. One, I think this is a obviously I'm a co-sponsor on the bill, so I'm not completely unbiased and want to support your effort. But I think this illustrates a point that is easily missed when we're trying to set healthcare policy, which is that ultimately, if you're not creating a change in behavior for the individual, which can certainly flow through an organization, as you're describing, or it can just be up to the individual. But if you're not focused on changing behavior of the individual, then no amount of effort or expenditure is going to change the health outcome for that individual or for that population group. And so I think this is the kind of innovation in healthcare that we should be more focused on is trying to drive, create incentives so that organizations and individuals have financial incentives to be more healthy, to make healthy choices. So that was the comment. So I appreciate you bringing this bill forward and allowing me to support it. The two questions are, and I may have missed this, Dr. Mullins, in your testimony. First question, is Samaritan Health self-insured? I'm sorry. Is your organization self-insured?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are self-insured, which was one of the drivers that got us very interested in doing this. So we wanted to do it as healthcare practitioners, and what we've learned from it, we can now apply to the general population. But economics did drive us to move into this area, and that's why we wanted to share our results with you, is that as a business proposition, this makes good business sense. And this is something that can lower the operating cost of companies statewide if they embrace it and if they utilize it and if they do it properly. The other link we had to maybe fully respond to your question was we also have a health insurance plan. So as a health plan, we could see what the utilization was. So we were kind of looking at the front and the back side of the question. And I think what you said is absolutely correct. If you're going to impact this area, you have to do it through a societal cultural change, not just through macro type of policy development. You got to get to the individual. You have to do something that incentivizes and motivates them and then hold them accountable for it.
Thank you. May I ask my second question?
Yes, please.
I was just wondering if Representative Olson could do that ventriloquist trick again where he didn't move his mouth but threw his voice when Dr. Mullins was testifying.
Thank you, Representative Pence.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yes.
Representative, if I could respond to that, Representative Olson has done that to me many times.
So I'm a custom victim, too, so I sympathize.
Oh, wow.
Thank you. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question, I think you mentioned it just briefly, is that the investment today to return someday, and then the measure of when we would see these reductions that we all hope occur, because there's a lot of reluctance in investing in things that make our lives better someday, because we've got to pay today. So what is that? I almost hate to add up the numbers to see how much we're going to invest before we start seeing the return. Can you maybe share with us how long we're going to wait to see the beneficial outcome promised by this bill, which, by the way, I co-sponsor also. So,
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you for your co-sponsorship as well, and I think your point's an important one for any business enterprise to take into consideration is if you make the investment now, how long before you get the return on it? It was the question that we agonized over a lot because, again, we had a large number of people that were participating, and while we thought it would work, we didn't know it would work. So when we got downstream about 18 months, when we had into the second year, we could actually measure the outcomes. And while we were tracking the cost of health care, we saw a quicker return than we anticipated. So I guess part of the answer to the question is you should be able to recognize a return within 12 to 24 months if you utilize a similar program model to what we utilize. But I'll stress again, a high part of our program model was accountability. So case in point, the people, when they went to the SAMFIT centers, had to be checked in. We have a swipe card. It's very automated for them. And then they would get tracked on that, and then their life coaches, which were assigned to them, would communicate with them. So it was an ongoing check process. The other two elements to it to mention real quickly was low cost of entry and no barriers to entry. So rather than some models which charge like membership fees to get into the program up front and then charge like a monthly fee, there was no membership fee to get in. It was just an access fee on a monthly basis. And I think on average about $40 a month was the cost of the employee. If the employee engaged in it, it was no cost to the general public. But you can see where that $300 annually, that $40 per month figure get in the same area. So now we're having conversations with businesses in our community about utilizing and adopting this program and thinking that they'll see the same results. So 12 to 24 months if it's implemented properly.
Yes, please.
And the return, how do you measure it? In other words, we know exactly how much we're going to be putting into it on the from the standpoint of the subtraction. How do you come back and explain to us how much we are getting back? I mean, there seems to be quite a bit of opportunity to use loose numbers. How's that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think there's a couple of ways you could measure the return back to it. From the employer's perspective, it would be the cost of their health care. So what do they pay in annualized premiums for the health care costs? If they get a healthier workforce, that's going to go down. From the employer and society's perspective, increased productivity. If we get increased productivity, then that's beneficial to everybody because they're going to get more work product out and more sales and services into the community. From the state's perspective, if productivity increases and sales and services are going up, they're going to have a larger tax base to get returns from in terms of activity.
Mr. Chair, I mean, okay, that all sounds great, but I want the numbers. We need to have the specifics. The general statements, we need
well,
to have
I can tell you our numbers, what Mr. Chairman, I can share with you that in our case, we probably saw a savings reduction of in excess of $2 million over a 12-month period. About $1 million of that came to us, as I stated earlier, on the workers' compensation safe type of cost to us, and I can't demonstrate a direct correlation between that and the other, but it's the first time it happened that way. The other area that I saw that reduction in was the cost of my health care. So remember, again, we have an advantage. We know what the health care costs. We knew what the real number was going into it. So we could measure exactly what a cost is going out. And even compensating for increase in health care costs, which do happen and will happen going forward even, we saw a reduction of our cost of that. So from an employer's perspective, in excess of $2 million over a 24-month period.
Forgive me, Mr. Chair, but we'll have a final question.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean anything unless we know how many people we're talking about. So $2 million, how big is your base? How many people, 500 people, 10 million
Mr.
people?
Chairman, Representative, we had about 3,500 people in the study. First year out, I think it was 34, 72, 92. Second year was about 3,500. The total population that was eligible was about 5,000. So we had about two-thirds of our employees, and in part because this was a voluntary basis. So, again, we had to create an incentive to get them to engage in the activity, to get them to engage in the things we knew or felt would affect their status. If it would have been mandated, the number would have been 5,000. But then you get into a lot of bargaining issues with contracts and labor and so forth to where you got to get agreement on each and every one of these principles. So we chose to take what I think was the better route of saying, here's why you should do this, we encourage you to do this, but we couldn't require them to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did I understand you to say that you're self-insured both for workers' comp and for health?
No, actually the workers' comp, we get through, I think it's a state program, but we pay into it, our premiums dropped, right?
But your premiums dropped $1 million. That's where the $1 million.
That's where the million savings came from.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Nadine Wood and John Lees. And I will note for those who are testifying that we are going to break from this bill at 10 minutes after 9. We'll come back to it if we're not finished at that time.
Representative, Chair Representative Barnhart and members of the House Committee, my name is Nadine Wood and I'm from Albany, Oregon, and I want to thank you today for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 4072. As the employee wellness coordinator at iCare Associates, I've had the opportunity to be responsible for planning and implementation of a small-scale wellness program at iCare Associates, which has three different offices, Albany, Lebanon, and Corvallis. Participation in the volunteer program is currently at 70% of all qualifying employees. While the data from this group is much too small to do any kind of measurements, as we just saw from Dr. Mullins, I do think that there have been some very important individual changes and personal health goals reached. A few have quit smoking, many more have lost weight and kept it off, and have shown improvement in their one-mile timed walks as well as decreasing their body mass index. More than that, what I find is interesting is the ripple effect. We have employees that are participating in the program, and then those outside of the program are still talking about and getting involved in some ways in kind of the wellness climate at their work site. Employees are excited about the opportunity to learn healthy options, to feed off of each other, to do some group activity around wellness, and they also like the financial reward for doing so. Small businesses make up a large majority of the Oregon of businesses in Oregon. House Bill 4027 will encourage more employees to participate in wellness, employers to offer wellness programs, and strengthen Oregon's vision and commitment to a healthier population. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lees.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is John Lees. I'm from Albany. And do you have this
little brochure here?
Yeah, I wanted to start on page 10. And this is kind of the concept. And what I want to try to argue for is that this bill could be a revenue producer very easily for the state of Oregon. And what you see there on page 10 are two companies. A is a normal company. B is a company with a good wellness program where your health insurance and safety costs go down. When the health insurance costs go down, the profits go up, and the profits are taxed. And then if you look at page 9 on this, it's an accountant, Tom Glogau, who's here to help us with questions, view of it. And you can see with $300 tax-exempt, the state would lose $27. However, if we can reduce health care costs by 15%, there would be a gain of $60. So the net estimate gain would be $33. The break-even point is 6.75. If we can reduce health care costs by 6.75%, the tax flow into the state would equal the tax we lose. That'd be the neutral point. And as Dr. Mullins has said, he's far exceeded that, and I think this program would also do it. So that's my testimony, and I'll answer any questions.
Very good. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Glogau. I'm a CPA. You've got a long day ahead of you, and you don't need to listen to a CPA drone on about numbers. Dr. Lees has explained it. If you save money, your profits go up, and that increases the tax. My job was to give an estimate as to what might it take in order to make the bill revenue neutral.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
Just a comment. Thank you very much. And I wish all employers would pay as much attention to the culture of their employees' health as they do to other things. This would, on the face of it, without any bill, make a huge difference. Thank you for your
work. Yes. I'd like to second that. I think wise managers, wise business managers, pay attention to everything that may improve their product and reduce their costs. This paying attention to the health of your employees is part of that, and I appreciate very much your bringing that to our attention.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go ahead then with Jim Aslison and John Powell, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 4072. My name is Jim Aslison, and I'm the executive director of the Mid-Willamette Family YMCA in Albany, Oregon. Have had the privilege to serve there since 1994. Previous to that, I've served YMCAs in Colorado Springs, Charlotte, and Portland over the past 35 years. My interest today is shared by many, and that is what we see as the opportunity for the YMCA to improve the nation's health and well-being, and certainly that's part of our platform. In Albany last year, we had 100,000 visits to the YMCA. The vast majority of those came to in pursuit of a healthier lifestyle. My experience is that many of them are more successful when they're engaged in that effort with other folks who have similar goals. It's hard to do it on your own. We see that every January, and we look for the same people in March and April. Some of them happen to be gone. Those that stay tend to get connected, and that's what this is all about. This is about workplace wellness. We believe in that so much that at the YMCA, your entire family is automatically a member when you become an employee, and there are no additional costs to pursue programs and services at the YMCA. But beyond that, I think it's important to know that people really need three things. They need support, they need encouragement, they need expertise. And as we all know, whether it's a retail discount, whether it's an interest savings on a mortgage, or something else that might incentivize you, it tends to be more successful for encouragement when there's a financial incentive. And so I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of human nature and people wanting to benefit on both the front end with some sort of incentive and over the long term by committing to a program, as Dr. Mullins mentioned, and the accountability that comes with that, not only to yourself, but to your fellow worker and perhaps to your family. And so we really believe in the encouragement that can be provided with the Oregon Health Dividend Incentive. Secondly, the support's important because people are more successful when they do these things with others, as I mentioned previously, especially for people that you spend 8 to 10 to maybe longer hours a day with in the workplace. That's true at the YMCA, and that's true in a number of workplaces. And lastly, people need expertise. It's hard to do it on your own, not just from a time and from a support standpoint, but to know who to go to, where to get the help so that you can get on the right track, get a coach, get some other folks similar directed in their own lifestyle goals. So in our case, we have found that of those 100,000 visits, the vast majority are more successful and stay longer when they get that support, encouragement, and expertise, and I think the Oregon Health Dividend is a way for that to happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Powell.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, this is the second or third time we've testified in favor of bills like this. We had a very similar workers' comp results at Regents with a health program that Dr. Mullins presented to you. I must confess that I have a special place in my heart for this bill because Dr. Lees was a constituent of mine back in the days when I chaired the Senate Revenue Committee and stepped on many a tax credit air hose. And so I understand the pressure that the legislature is under when it comes to expending revenue through tax credits. I understand that fully. But health care and the wellness of Oregonians is going to be done one life at a time. It's not going to be improved by some magic wand. And as we saw when PEB introduced their program, a lot of consternation was expressed by employees. I attended some of those meetings, and they were very, very angry about the fact that it was being imposed upon them. I think this approach of the carrot will work in the workplace, and it spreads. And Dr. Lee's example of how they've handled that is proof of that. And Regents had very similar responses in a program where people, it just caught on, and people were proud of the progress they made in their health. So we would heartily support this measure.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you. We really appreciate your testimony today. David Roth, please. And is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on this bill? We have just a couple more minutes. Mr. Roth, thank you.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is David Roth. I'm a member of Tax Fairness Oregon, and I'm here to raise questions about this bill, in particular the plausibility of the employee incentive of a $300 or $500 or perhaps $300 tax subtraction. We fully appreciate, as the committee does, the value of employer-sponsored wellness programs. It's not just true in Oregon that these programs work. It's true across. It's been shown in many cases across the country. The main question is whether this augmentation of the basic incentive of a free program will make a difference in the commitment of an employee to participate. It's our feeling that the actual result, benefit of $30 or $40 in the person's tax bill at the end of the year will actually make any difference in the person's commitment to the program. If a boss says, I'll give you $500 to pay for this quit smoking program, if you'll go for a full 12 months, we doubt that anyone will ask, will I have to pay taxes on that $500 before saying, it sounds good to me. The very biggest tax break would be, if we stick with $500, $50, while the typical tax break will be in the $30 range. No one will notice the gift at tax time, because the benefit will just be included in the W-2. If the person begins to lose enthusiasm during the program because it's inconvenient, it's hard work, and they don't like the way the program is run, they're still not likely to care much that they'll save $30 or $40 or $50 at tax time. What will really matter is whether they think they have to pay for the program if they quit ahead of time. In recent sessions, the governor and the legislature have carefully repaired troublesome financial leaks in the ship of state. They included the Betsy's, certain PERS benefits, and the senior medical deduction. The governor and the legislature hope to reach a destination where the revenues of the state will be reliable and adequate enough to restore the proud reputation of our educational system. If the legislature allows new leaks to develop by granting new tax expenditures that do not serve the fundamental priorities of the state, the ship may never get to port. This is one of those seems great bills where legislators should think again.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Roth? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony, and with that, we will close the public hearing.
Oh, Mr. Chair,
excuse me.
Let me make a quick suggestion about this.
Representative Conger?
I was just listening to the testimony and the questions asked by Representative Bentz, and I was thinking also about Dr. Mullen's response about seeing a result in a year. I was going to suggest that maybe I could work with Representative Olson to make this have a three-year sunset, 3 years being an adequate time to see results and find out if it's actually helping and employers are adopting it, and maybe add some reporting requirements by employers who avail themselves of the program so that there would be actual data, numbers, to show the impact.
Thank you. I think that's a useful exercise. Appreciate it. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4072, and we're going to move to our 9 o'clock item and move and open public hearings on two bills, House Bill 4055 and House Bill 4080. And we're going to hear first from Mazin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members.
And you're not going to talk about that whole file, are you? The correct answer is no.
Not today.
Thank you.
But I have in the documents that for the bills, I have it in meeting materials, since we don't, so we're going to talk about both the bills in the same time. The first, I have two documents here. One of them is a run through both of the bills, House Bill 4055, House Bill 4080, and those primarily has the different sections of where the bills are going with the solutions that they're proposing. I could go in more of the details of these.
Well, these are the two concepts, aren't they, that we've looked at pretty carefully before. If I understand it, one of them has to do with a clarification of the existing rule to require carriers to collect and remit the tax themselves, and the other has to do with the point-of-sale process. Have I got that correct?
House Bill 4055 is the one that is an enforcement bill, Mr. Chair, and the 4080 introduces the point-of-sale concept. Slightly different than what we looked before.
Great. Okay, slightly different. Great. Thank you very much, and with that, we'll hear from Speaker Kotek. Are there other members who want to be heard this morning? Madam Speaker, thank you for coming this morning. Appreciate your...
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Nice to see you all. It's nice to get out of my office. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, Speaker of the House. Thank you for the opportunity to say a few words this morning about the two bills you have in front of you regarding the 911 system and our ability to close a loophole for people who have prepaid cell phones who aren't contributing to our 911 system. I want to start off by thanking, there are many members on this panel, you know who you are, who have lived and breathed these proposals for quite some time. So we have two bills, and I want to say that I am encouraged that we are on the pathway to a proposal that looks to combine both elements of both bills, carrier remit and point of sale. Because I just want to remind, I think, why we're all here and why this conversation has gone on so long, because it's important to figure out how to find that equity in the system, closing that loophole, making sure folks who are having prepaid cell phones are contributing to 911, because we all want access to that system, and trying to do something this session to put money into the system, to help our emergency responders, to help our local government. So I think we're all committed to that topic, so that's why we're here again, and I think we're on a pathway to get that right. I also want to thank not only the members of this panel, but the stakeholders who've been working very hard on this, the carriers, the advocates for emergency response community, saying we need to figure this out. So there's been a lot of good work going on, and I think that's why we've seen progress, and I think we have, you know, a pathway to get it done. We are working on a combination of carrier remit and point of sale to have that proposal move out of this committee as soon as we can possibly do that. And so I think today is a starting, you know, put some ideas out on the table, but know that our office and working with the stakeholders are very interested in getting something done that combines the two proposals. Because it needs to be doable and feasible. Because one of the things that we said to folks after last session was we have to have a proposal that pencils out, that gets us money, additional money for the system this biennium, but also can pay for itself, be legal and practical and all those good things. Because I think if we work together, we can solve this problem and come up with a proposal. What I wanted to particularly put on the record today is a set of principles that I'm working under, that I'm hoping all of us are working under to get to a solution. First of all, one of the very important things that's going on in Department of Revenue right now is the core system rollout. You've had numerous presentations in this committee about that. We all understand the good work the department is doing, their attention to detail, and their desire to have that rollout go smoothly. It's important for the entire state. So whatever we do has to have that bigger context in mind, the timing, the implementation of core system rollout, and trying to do something additional in a state where we don't have a sales tax. So we have to keep those that timing in mind. We want to bring money in this biennium. We don't want to put something out for another couple of years, because we all know, if you haven't heard from your city folks yet, you know that 911 needs additional money now. So that's got to be a goal. We want to also have a proposal that moves a technically feasible point of sale forward on a specified date. I think going forward, we all can see how markets are changing and prepaid cell phones are the wave of the future. So making it technically feasible, but knowing when we can implement it so as not to negatively impact core system rollout. We also want to give carrier certainty, because the carriers think point of sale is a better way to go. So where is that certainty? When's that point in time when we can actually start it? And then lastly, we just have to be thoughtful about the implementation timeline and the cost of doing that. We don't want to implement something and then spend all the money to implement it and not get any money into the system. So timing, implementation costs, all those things have to be worked out. So we have a series of questions into the Department of Revenue. They're working, trying to answer some of those questions about timing and implementation costs, some portion of remit, when do you start point of sale. And I think if all the stakeholders working together, continuing the conversations that have been going on since the end of last session, we can get this done. So I'm firmly committed to that. I think if we stick to the principles of how we implement this, what the cost is, and getting money this biennium, I think we have a solution at hand. So I just wanted to thank you for the work you're doing. Thank the stakeholders. Look forward to the testimony today. I'll be watching in my office. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for the speaker?
No, just to thank you for the speaker to come down here today, as someone who has worked on this very hard. I appreciate the effort. And by way of question, we have before us two bills. What is being proposed is amendments or a new bill that would combine the elements you're speaking of. Would it be your office who would be proactive in getting those bills or whatever compromise amendments to LC and back to this committee?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Berger, absolutely. I'd like to have one amendment coming out of our office working, which either bill makes the most sense, but we have two vehicles. One has a bigger relating clause, so it might be a better vehicle, but working through on one amendment so there's not confusion.
Through your office.
Through our office,
thank
yes.
you. I just wanted to be sure.
And one other thing is that I think the work that's been gone on with the stakeholders around some of the technical details that kind of were a hang-up last year around how do you define point of sale and VoIP and how do you actually pay for, I mean, all that stuff, I feel like there's been great progress on the details. So, like I said, I think we're close. We'd like to be the point on that amendment, and we'll be back hopefully before the end of the week with some language to show folks.
Great. Thank you. We appreciate it.
The comments you
made at the beginning about how this committee has been deeply involved in this project, I think, is a if anything, an understatement. And we appreciate the acknowledgement. I'm also extremely interested to get this off of our list of things to do. And so we appreciate that as well. And I guess my final comment is that I'm very pleased to see that it looks like we're coming to some sort of an agreement, because my inclination is to move a bill. And I'd prefer to, I mean, it's no secret that I prefer the mechanism that simply involves an enforcement process. But I'd be extremely pleased if we had an agreement that the committee could adopt that meets the criteria that you already outlined.
And I think we can bring it home, Mr.
Great.
Chair. So we'll thank be
you.
Back. So thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. So having heard all of that we're likely to get a new proposal next week, let's go through our list of witnesses and start with Asena Squires, Bob Livingston, and Mary Botkin. Please.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires, and I'm here today before you on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon chapters of APCO-NENA, an organization that represents the professional 911 centers. You've got my written testimony. I'm not going to go through all of it. I'd just like to start out by just saying that this issue has been going on for a long time, and we, too, are very hopeful that this will be resolved this session, and are also encouraged by the discussions that have been taking place between industry and public safety most recently. So we do have a 75-cent tax. It's been in place for almost 2 decades, which is somewhat hard to believe, but it is creeping up onto almost 2 decades for this tax to have been instituted at the current level that it's at. Cities and counties are the big beneficiaries. I don't represent cities and counties in that sense. I represent special districts, and a large portion of those districts are fire districts who respond to calls that come into 911 centers. There are two bills before you, House Bill 4055, which is an identical copy of House Bill 2036A that passed last legislative session off the House floor. And the reason that that bill is here is truly for tax compliance and tax enforcement. Department of Revenue initiated rulemaking Department of Revenue initiated rulemaking to force collection of that prepaid cell phone tax, and was advised by Department of Justice that there were some gray areas in the statute that potentially opened the state to litigation. And so the reason this issue all came about and these bills have been floating before you is to close that loophole, to explicitly provide Department of Revenue with the certainty that they need that the statute is clear and Department of Justice can not have to litigate something in the future. So House Bill 4055 does provide an additional 0.25% to Department of Revenue to enforce that collection mechanism, and does make some changes in the statute in the wording to close that loophole. House Bill 4080 is essentially the -17 amendment from House Bill 3317A last legislative session. I kind of hesitate to say -17 because we got, I think, all the way up to -26 last legislative session. So the bill sets up a point of sale method of collection. One of the big concerns that from public safety has been, if you go with carrier remit, it costs less. There'll be more net revenue into the system than point of sale. And House Bill 4080 attempts to address that issue. So under previous legislative sessions, carrier remit would have netted grossed $2.1 million in revenue, cost the Department of Revenue $200,000, which would have then allowed for a $1.9 million distribution in a biennium to local governments. The initial bills considered on point of sale last legislative session were estimated to raise the same amount of revenue, $2.1 million, and cost $1.9 million, which would have netted $200,000 statewide. And so public safety was very concerned that the cost of that program was going to be too expensive and really wouldn't pencil out. Why would you advocate for 20 cents on the dollar when you could have 80 cents on the dollar? I'm not sure I did that math right, but you get my point. House Bill 4080 attempts, and this is based upon a lot of discussion between public safety and industry, to correct that issue and guarantee the same amount of revenue under point of sale versus carrier remit, which I think industry was willing to acquiesce to, that we'll make sure that you get the same dollar amount. The way this bill, House Bill 4080, as printed, is currently constructed, and these are issues that we've discussed with industry, and we've had some good discussion, and I feel that there's been a great deal of progress on these issues. So I'm going to outline them for you, but don't think of them as these are lines in the sand, that we have a difference in opinion on these things. We're working together to address these technical issues that do not deal with the dollar amount. So the first thing in House Bill 4080 is that the bill doesn't address VoIP, and Voice Over Internet Protocol is an extremely important issue that we'd like to see addressed in the bill. Also, Department of Justice on this issue had raised a couple of Equal Protection Clause issues. We're working with the industry to remedy those. I won't belabor you with what they are. There's a provision on requiring out-of-state, allowing out-of-state retailers to the Department of Revenue to be able to remit the tax. There's a preemption on local governments remitting the tax. These are all things that we're working towards that we think that we will be able to find some common ground in the language once the issues related to how much it's going to cost to implement, when it will be implemented, and how that revenue will flow in. I just like to close by saying it'd be really easy to get up here and just say, we'd just like you to solve it. Please do something. Just do anything. We'll take anything. My client's perspective is we don't want just anything. If you do something, the whole reason that we're here is because of a potential litigation risk and Department of Revenue saying we don't feel sound in the ability to collect this tax. So what we would like is something that addresses all of these issues that industry appears to be willing to work with us on, and something that doesn't open us up to litigation and doesn't contain components that don't need to be in the bill, like preemption and other things. So with that, I'd just like to turn it over to Bob and Mary and thank the committee. I think we'll probably have some great progress this week and hopefully not ever talk about prepaid cell phones in the future.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75. We represent the folks who say to your constituents, police, fire, or medical. We represent the folks who answer all the calls when your constituents are at their worst in crisis. Hacina did a great job of sort of laying out all the issues that are before you. My job is to remind you that this is about response to an emergency. It's about the men and the women who answer the calls and need properly funded systems. They need the best equipment, and they need it now. They don't need it tomorrow. They need it now. And if you're the one making the phone call, you want that system to work. We don't care how you fund it, but it needs to be funded. I have worked on this issue since Gary Wilhelm lobbied for AT&T, and he and I together in 1981 worked on the original bill to establish some sort of fee-based system that would properly fund 911 services. And in our view, it was about getting good equipment and making sure that rural Oregon had the same resources available to them that urban Oregon had and that the valley had. And somehow this has devolved into a power struggle between the industry, the telephone industry, and 911. And that's not what this should be about. And we need to modernize the way we tax, the way we collect, the way we initiate the fee, and the way we collect the fee. The system has changed. You know, we now have cell phones. The worst thing in the world is to look at your cell phone and see no service, because we expect that there will always be service for us, and there isn't always service. We need to make sure that we're doing what makes sense. Now, I told Hacina that I'm going to do something I have never done before.
I have just spent the last 90 days being a housewife. You know, in my husband and I have known each other for 50 years or better. We've been married for 40 of them. We have never lived together in all those years 24/7. We have never spent that much time together. So this was like a whole new thing for me, being a wife and person with another person all the time. Daytime television, you know, it is mind-numbing. But I saw Hasina at an event. I told her, I said, I was ready to throw things at my husband's beautiful new flat screen TV, because every other commercial, it seemed like, was Fred and Harry talking about how they could use this phone for $19 a month, and they didn't have to have a contract, and they didn't have to talk to anybody, and they didn't have to sign any agreements, and you know, we can just throw it away when we're done. Why should we pay for services we don't need? You know, like 911. Now, they have to be able to connect to 911, but they don't have to pay for it. So it's free. Well, it's not free. And it shouldn't be free. And if I had my way, at the end of this little commercial, they would be forced to say, oh, and we don't pay for 911 services. Oh, and there's a chance that if you drive off the road, we won't be able to find you. Because you just assume we will. And it is offensive to me that somebody like Tim Tebow can say to everybody in America that's watching the Super Bowl, I was not one of them, but that he can say to America, I don't have a contract, you don't need one either. And if you sign up for T-Mobile, we can make a deal with you. You don't have to have a contract. Well, you know what? I got a T-Mobile phone that's going to become an AT&T phone. Because I'm offended by that. And I don't want my service provider to say that. So, having said all that, you know, fix the system. Do what needs to be done. And do it for your constituents and our members so that we all have a really good system that we can depend on. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I'll be very brief. I certainly appreciate not only the hard work and effort that's been brought about by this committee and many members of the committee. This is a complex issue, and I'm encouraged by, in the recent past 2 weeks, some of the conversations that have taken place between many of the stakeholders. I truly believe that there is a possibility for what I would refer to as a transitionary period to take place in a concept that hopefully will be ready soon for you to at least figure out and hopefully move forward with. I would simply just close with this. As somebody that's been and proud to be a member of the public safety community for over 20 years, and understanding the importance of not only what 911 means to the people that I raise my right hand and swear to protect, but also how important the 911 system is to the men and women right now outside of this building who are responding to emergencies every day. The technology that has improved has not only made our jobs safer, but it also has made it more difficult in the sense that with the proliferation of cell phones and all that, there's instant access to the 911 system. And so while technology has helped, at the same time, technology and the revenues haven't kept pace in order for us to effectively do our job in a safe manner and to effectively do the things that we need to do in order to protect our communities. And so all I would suggest to you is I would beg, since we just had a Groundhog's Day and know that there's 6 more weeks of winter, let's not have another 6 weeks or 6 years on this issue. I would ask you to, I will commit as someone that represents the firefighters, I will work hard with the industry in order to get a deal done that not only meets the criteria that it was established by the speaker, but to make sure that we don't have to have another Groundhog's Day to talk about this issue, but finally resolve it. Because the fact is, not to embellish this, the face of this is not so much about the technical components of how to implement DOR, the legal components that Hasina has talked about, the industry's angst to do this, stakeholders' unwillingness to do this. The bottom line is this is a public safety issue, and it's something that as a legislative body and as Oregonians, we should solve now. And I'll give you my commitment that my organization's committed to getting it done now. We will need your help and the prodding of not only the House, but certainly the Senate and the governor. But I think there is a path. And I would just ask, when the prodding needs to be prodded, please prod us and let's get this thing done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I am tempted to note that those of us who work in this building have very unusual ways of perception around issues that we work with all the time that other people simply don't get. Your story about Super Bowl commercials, I think, definitely fits that criteria, and I appreciate it. Thank you. David Stuckey, Mark Tennyson, and how about Larry Hatch?
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chairs Berger and Bailey, and members of the committee. I'm Dave Stuckey. I'm the Director of the Office of Emergency Management. With me today from our office is...
Good morning. Mark Tennyson. I'm the Section Manager for Technology and Response at the Office of Emergency Management and the State 911 Program Manager.
Why don't you two go ahead, and then we'll hear from Mr. Hatch.
Sure. Well, we'd like to thank you for all the hard work that you've done on these bills and also this session as well as last session. We'd like to go on record to state that our office encourages a fair and equitable assessment of the tax for all devices capable of reaching the 911 centers. The current 911 tax on average supports approximately 30%, and then the remainder 70% goes to the is from the locals and raised by the locals. The statewide volume is going down, or correction, is holding steady, and the total revenue is going down slightly. From the biennium to biennium, it's been about a $650K decrease. We ask that whatever collection method that you choose, whether it's carrier remit or point of sale, whether it's some type of method in between, as Speaker Kotek mentioned right up front, we ask that it be fair and equitable for both the wireline, the wireless, as well as the VoIP. And so that's all we wanted to say today. We want to thank you for the efforts that you put into this, and we certainly hope that that you will see the continued success. So,
thank you.
I would just echo what Mr. Stuckey said, that we have seen the call volume has, in some cases across the state, certain 911 centers has increased. Overall, it's definitely remained steady. But as Dave pointed out, the revenues have declined, and we have to just point out, where is that money going today? So as Dave said, we're just asking for the method to be equitable across all devices. As Hasina pointed out earlier, and also Mary, the calls continue to come in to the 911 call takers from several different devices across the state, and we're not getting the revenue to help support that need, both in equipment and personnel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we'll hear from Washington County.
Chair Barnhart, committee members, I have handed out written testimony, but
And for the record, would you identify yourself?
For the record, I'm Larry Hatch. I'm an assistant director at Washington County 911 and the co-chair of the Oregon Afghanina Legislative Committee. Very encouraged by what I hear today. You've heard that we've had a steady loss of revenue. Quarter over quarter, we see at the PSAP that it's gone down. Our call volume increases. To work out something that gets the right amount, the correct amount of revenue from all devices that use the system into the PSAP, that's what we're looking for. And I'm very excited about what the speaker has said today, and look forward to continuing to work with everyone to get the right bill for us.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony this morning. Patrick Thang, Andy Smith, Craig Honeywell, please.
Honeyman.
I'm sorry?
Honeyman.
Honeyman. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I know very well what your name is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. As you know, we represent not only county commissioners, but also part of our membership includes sheriffs, community corrections directors, emergency managers, public safety communicators, and also juvenile department directors who all use the public safety communication spectrum. So this is a very important bill to us. Some of the principles that have been talked about already are issues that we also believe are important for whatever proposal is going forward. Our legislative committee, through our communications committee and public safety committee, have had a long-time position on the bill that is now House Bill 4055. We're in support of that bill. We haven't taken a position on 4080, but I can say that one of the concerns that we have that I understand is still under discussion in for the folks that are negotiating is the preemption of local tax. You may recall last session we passed House Bill 3253, which is for counties under fiscal distress, and one of those options for the governor to be able to come in and work with local government leaders on potential revenue options is an additional tax on 911 communications. We have a number of counties that are hurting very much. We have Josephine County down in southern Oregon that's down to that had up to this point just one sheriff's deputy on patrol during the day, and that was the sheriff. He's just now added one deputy. We have Curry County and Columbia County who are at risk of shutting down their jail. Polk County and other ONC counties are in dire needs as well. So our counties are looking for help in terms of options that they can use, and that is certainly one of those. So I was encouraged by the discussions that we've had so far about progress that's moving forward in the bills. So again, we look forward to resolution on this topic as well, and happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Andy Smith for the City of Portland. This issue continues to be a top priority for the City of Portland, and you have our written testimony, which indicates we support both bills. The message is that we support finding a resolution and passing something this session, and we're encouraged by what we've heard today that something passing this session might be possible. As this loophole remains open, it means about $1 million a year for the City of Portland's 911 call center. So we certainly hope that revenue can start being collected in the near term, and that something will pass this session. So thank you very much for all the work on it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director, League of Oregon Cities. I appear before you this morning to support the inclusion of prepaid under the 911 tax. Hope this is the last time panels like this have to come before you and talk about this matter, and I too am encouraged about what I've heard this morning. In 2013, you passed an extension of the sunset date through the year 2021. Now I urge you to finish the job, and that's to include prepaid services and devices, including voice over internet, under the tax. I guess the message I want to leave with you today is that every day that goes by that we don't do this, we're leaving unrecoverable revenues on the table. And it's all about public safety, as has been mentioned before. Wireless is the dominant technology in the telecom business these days, and prepaid is a growing portion of that market. Up to 20%, I'm told, of all wireless products and services are now prepaid, and it's growing at a rapid rate as customers abandon their contract-based plans. So the sticking point has been the collection methodology, and again, I'm encouraged by what I'm hearing today about the parties coming together and coming up with, I guess, what I would call a hybrid approach or a system that will address the concerns about collection. This is not a radical notion, including prepaid under the tax. It's a matter of equity, making sure that all telephonics are taxed in the same way, and it's an issue of stable funding for an emergency communication system that is now stressed. It is unable to acquire the latest and greatest technology. Again, public safety is job one for local governments, and passage of a bill that includes prepaid is a critical component of that. I appreciate your attention and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you. I appreciate your testimony this morning. Elise Brown, John Powell, please. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on these two bills? Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Berger. Elise Brown for AT&T, and here my comments will reflect those of the wireless industry. As representatives of the wireless industry, we join our speaker, our public safety partners, in an effort to bring as much 911 revenue into the system as possible. And we all agree it's time for prepaid wireless customers to pay into the 911 system for access to 911. As an industry, we've been clear and consistent in our message that point-of-sale collection is fair and equitable and, more importantly, brings more revenue into the system than provider pays. Just for reference, currently 32 states have adopted point-of-sale NCSL endorsed language and have enjoyed greater revenues in support of their 911 programs. For a recent example, Pennsylvania, who started a provider pays collection methodology, switched to point of sale and has enjoyed a 40% increase in revenues. So as the speaker said boldly this morning, we are on a pathway to get it right. So we're not here to say yes to the point of sale bill or no to the provider pays bill, but tell you the work that we've done recently during the legislative interim has been reaching out to all of our public safety partners to talk about how we can walk forward. And the result of those discussions are represented through what has been referred to as a hybrid plan. So it's not one or the other, but it's a pathway down the middle, a combination of the two. And we believe one that represents collaboration between public safety stakeholders and the wireless industry. And most importantly, it addresses the principles that the speaker raised this morning and also concerns from the public safety group. So currently, we are ready to sit down and roll up our sleeves and work with the speaker and the rest of the public safety community to get the language returned to this committee as a team, and not a separate wireless panel or a public safety panel, but as a panel that represents collaborative work for your approval. We all share the same goal this morning. So delighted to hear that. And we look forward to coming back with a plan that we know and feel strongly we can implement in 2014. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Powell.
John C. Powell, representing AT&T. Elise covered the basics, and I just wanted to put on the record my personal thanks to Mr. Livingston and Ms. Squires for hearing us out and working with us to find a compromise solution. And though I'm just a lobbyist and not a paid spokesman, I would like to, on the record, thank AT&T's newest customer, Mary Botkin.
Thank you very much. We need those kinds of comments in a committee like this one. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 4055 and House Bill 4080. Paul, do you have time? Is this enough time, 10 minutes, for you to go on to 4003? All right, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4003.
It was...
Yeah. And I think Chris is going to walk us through it. Do we have some people signed up?
Nobody.
No. Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4003 is the annual Reconnect Bill. And for better or worse, this might be the most boring version of the bill that's ever existed.
Is there a less boring version?
We've been hearing on the news for weeks that the Congress has done less than any other Congress in history, and so you better be born.
Well, the current tie date is January 3rd of 2013, and this bill would move the tie date up to December 31st. 2013, which is the traditional tie date.
At least there was.
And as you recall from last session, the January 3rd date was chosen to tie to ATRA. And I'm still trying to confirm this, but I think since the passage of ATRA on January 2nd, no other tax bills have been passed,
okay.
Which is why the boring comment. And this right now it's likely to have an actual no impact statement, which I don't know has ever been done for the Reconnect bill. The one thing that's different in this bill is a technical nature in sections 14 and 15. It combines several of the property tax references into one statute. So the bill in future years will be shorter. Basically, as you recall, there are a number of statutes, and somewhere buried in the statute there's a reference to the date, December 31st, whatever. In talking to Ledge Council, that creates a lot of work for them for the property tax statutes. And so there will be a new statute in Chapter 305 which references about eight or so property tax statutes, and it just changes the structure. It'll just put the date in one statute. It consolidates the date into one statute rather than the seven or eight statutes. So that's in looking through the bill, that's the one difference from prior years. And we're still looking, confirming that there aren't any other technical problems with the bill, making sure that we've referenced all statutes that need to be included.
No policy changes.
No policy changes.
This is a scrivener's fix, as it were.
Correct.
Okay.
In last session, one issue that's kind of come up is the earned income credit. That was handled a little bit differently last year. We want to make sure we're handling that correctly this year. So I don't anticipate any amendments, but there might be one for the EIC. We just need to do some double-checking on how that's being handled.
Great. Questions for Chris? The point of doing this, then, given the lack of action on the part of Congress, is to deal with these Scrivener issues and to make it easy for practitioners to realize that we're up to date on the Connect, even though the Connect date doesn't make any difference this time?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. There is always the chance that there is some bill that Congress passed and has been enacted that in some tangential way touches tax law. So it is very difficult to say with absolute certainty that there was no tax law that was changed. That requires an immense amount of work. But in talking with the OSCPA and our usual contacts, Department of Revenue, Ledge Council, when I ask people if they can think of any tax bills after ATRA that were passed in 2013, I just get blank stares. Nothing comes to mind, and as the committee is aware, tax law tends to be controversial. So if there are issues, people tend to be aware of them. Mm-hmm. And it is it is one of the reasons to take advantage of the even year regular session, just to keep it up to date and to keep it to the December 31st date. That's the end of the tax year for most filers.
Very good. Thank you. Anything else for Chris? I will note that with a busy morning, we still save you 7 minutes. See you tomorrow. Anything else, Paul? The committee's adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very efficient.